Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we are pleased to welcome Janet Tavakoli as our guest. Janet is the president of Tavakoli Structured Finance, a Chicago-based firm providing consulting services to financial institutions and institutional investors. She's also an expert on derivatives, the topic I'm most interested in discussing with her today. Janet is a former adjunct professor of derivatives at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, as well as author of several related books, including the titles Credit Derivatives and Synthetic Structures and Collateralized Debt Obligations and Structured Finance. Perfect titles for what we're going to talk about today. Readers of the site are familiar with my belief that derivatives represent a truly, potentially frightening financial time bomb. Global financial markets are literally awash in hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives, perhaps a quadrillion by some estimates. These are notional amounts. And I believe they are interconnected with such complexity that no one really can understand or forecast how this overall market will behave in reaction to some potential systemic shock. To be clear, I expect it's more likely than not that one of these shocks will occur in the next 2 to 4 years, and we're going to have to live with the consequences. The global network of derivatives is so enmeshed, it's possible, such a shock could create a cascading crisis that collapses faster than our current system safeguards can cope with. But let's ask the expert. Janet, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be with you.
Well, I hope I haven't scared you off with such a sobering introduction, but it reflects my idea that there's just some confusion and maybe fear of the unknown lurking in the derivatives markets.
Well, there is fear of the unknown, but let's get to the root cause of the fear of the unknown. And that's just not unique to derivatives, by the way. That's true of mm-hmm. bonds, of equities, of things that people are more familiar with. And the root cause of the problem remains the same, and that is unchecked fraud, widespread massive fraud in our financial system that has acted as a potent neurotoxin. Now, one example of this that was tangentially derivatives related is the failure of MF Global, where we haven't seen any indictments yet. And you've seen volumes collapse on the CME. They're down by around 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And people that I've spoken with who trade derivatives are distressed and terrified by the lack of regulation and the blasé attitude by Congress, not even blasé, I would say the enabling attitude by Congress and regulators that has allowed fraud to remain unchecked. And this is going to affect farmers being able to hedge the cost of growing food, and producers being able to hedge the costs of their raw materials.
Oh, I can't wait to dive into this topic more fully. As bad as MF Global was, I was even more shocked, if possible, by the Libor scandal. And that was the manipulation of an interest rate, which was and is tied to trillions in direct loans and hundreds of trillions in derivatives. So that was just remarkable. And the idea that the regulators should have probably did know that this was occurring and chose to look the other way is really sobering for me.
Well, yes, but it's, again, the same root cause of people in the financial system being able to do whatever they want and remain unchecked.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the root cause of it is control fraud, where you have a group of individuals who are well rewarded for this kind of behavior, and yet there is no punishment for this kind of behavior. And as long as we keep that in place, you will just see more of the same. And the way the Fed and regulators have chosen to deal with it is to pretend it's not happening and just continue to print money. And as I say, it acts as a neurotoxin in the financial system so that thinking people see this. And you have a number of short sellers who point out, you know, the fallacy of being able to carry on this way. And, you know, they put their money where their mouth is.
Oh, fascinating. Interesting you mentioned neurotoxin, because I was once upon a time a neurotoxicologist. So
yes, I know that.
Oh, so. You know that. So great. So good of you to weave that in. Well done. So let's start right at the beginning then. I want a few minutes here. Give us an overview of what is a derivative. So what is a derivative contract? How would we explain this so somebody who's not familiar them could understand what they are?
Okay, I'd like to explain it, and then I'd like to show what happens in real-life application and why it helped bring the global financial system to its knees. A derivative just means derived from. It's just referencing another obligation, like a bond or an equity, or you can even reference an option. You can have futures on options, as an example, or options on futures, rather. So a derivative, it's just like, handing out 50 photocopies of a model. You know, it's a derivative of something that actually exists. Let's take an example that might make it easier for your readers to understand. Goldman Sachs used derivatives. They help supply money to mortgage lenders by creating securitizations. And those securitizations were simply packaging up loans that were made by people like Countrywide, as an example. Countrywide, of course, was sued for fraud and settled for $8.3 billion with a number of different states for their predatory lending practices. So you take these bad loans, you package them up in securities, and if you can combine them with leverage, it will always look like you're making a lot of money. That's classic control fraud, as William Black so eloquently keeps explaining to the market, and as our financial media keeps ignoring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you combine it with leverage? Well, derivatives are a very handy item if you want to lever something up. So as an example, the Wall Street Journal looked at a $38 million subprime mortgage bond that Goldman created in June of 2006. And yet Goldman was able to leverage that up to cause around $280 million in losses to investors.
What?
Yes. Now, how did they do that? They did it with the magic of derivatives, because with a derivative, you can reference that toxic bond. That $38 million bond can be referenced. You can say, if that bond goes up or down in value, the value of your new securitization will change as that bond goes up or down in value. So you don't actually put that bond in a new securitization. Instead, you use a derivative, a credit derivative in this case, to reference that bond. And so with the credit derivative, you can basically create as many of those referenced entities as you want. Now, they stopped at around 30 debt pools. They could have done 130. Because with a credit derivative, all you're doing is saying, you're going to look to the value of that bond, and we're going to write a contract that your money is going to change when that bond goes up or down in value. That's a derivative. You're not actually putting the bond in. You're just referencing that bond. You're basically betting on the outcome of something, and you don't actually have to own that physical security. Now, that's a derivative, and that's how derivatives were used to amplify losses, to magnify losses, to make a bad situation much, much worse.
So if I was holding a derivative in my hands, what would I be holding physically?
You'd be holding a piece of paper.
So it's a contract?
That's right. And as I keep telling people, banks, when they trade with each other, often get into disputes because these nice kids write the contracts with something that we call asymmetry of information, so that the smarter bank will put terms into the contract that can disadvantage the other guy even more. And you found that happening in these securitizations, so that the contracts would basically say, if this minor event happens, I can basically say you're entertaining a total loss and you're going to lose your money. So that you not only were referencing a bad security, you were writing the contract in a bad way to disadvantage the person who would be on the hook for losses.
So this is a contract then, to maybe make it tangible for the average listener. It's a contract. It's a legal contract, maybe like a purchase and sale agreement or something. There's terms and conditions in there. We've identified some things, like in the case of When Greece was clearly defaulting, there were a whole lot of credit default swaps outstanding, maybe $78 billion worth at the notional level. And then those contracts would only get triggered because they had provisions in them if an actual default event occurred. And there was language, I guess, in this contract around that. And then there was an organizational body that was charged with determining whether a credit event had occurred or not, whether a default had occurred. Is that right?
Well, that was ISDA. But ISDA basically took it upon themselves to try to interpret the language of the contracts, and these are over-the-counter contracts, and, you know, basically stalled in terms of their definition of default. And it's people like me, I've written a whole book on credit derivatives, that say, you don't want to accept a contract that someone gives you, and you don't have to accept the language of ISDA, which is basically an organization that was created by the banks who trade credit default swaps. So they're going to have the most influence over what ISDA says, and that's happened time and again, by the way. And time and again through the years, there have been disputes about the interpretation of the language. So I always say you want to rewrite that language to make it as clear as possible, and if you don't like the terms and conditions, then rewrite them. And if you aren't in a strong enough position to make that happen, then don't play. And, of course, people widely ignore that advice. And why do they ignore it? Because of the temptation of leverage. People on the wrong side of the contract time and again hope and pray that leverage will work to their advantage and they'll have the big payday. And usually they're disappointed because the smarter guy wrote a contract that can disadvantage them when the chips are down. And Greece was a good example. In the end, the people who bought credit default protection on Greece did prevail because the situation in Greece deteriorated so badly. But ISDA did stall. They were very effective in stalling. And again, I tell people who are on the other side of that contract, well, you had to rewrite the contract at the outset. It's too late after you've done the contract to argue about the language.
So let's imagine you and I wrote a contract together. It was a derivatives contract. You're party A, I'm party B. We traded it over the counter, so it's in that market. And how, first of all, how
by
many...
By the way, Chris, I guarantee you, you do not want to be on the other side of the contract with me.
I'm sure of that. So let's pretend you and I wrote a contract together against another party. And so how, first of all, how complex is this piece of paper as you described it? Is it one page? Is it 30 pages?
Well, it can be as many pages as you like, but the important thing isn't the number of pages. The important thing is that you make the language clear so that you are only on the hook or you are protecting the scenarios that you want to protect or the scenarios for which you want to be on the hook. And that's the crucial element that people keep overlooking. Don't look at the number of pages. Look at, read the actual language.
Mm-hmm. And so let's imagine we've written one of these things, but now I don't want it anymore. Do we close it out with each other, or can I pass this on to another party, sell it to somebody else?
Well, it depends. You have to. It depends on what's going on in the market, because when you most need liquidity, it isn't there. And that's always true of leveraged products, by the way. The thing that people overlook is, and this is why fraud is such a potent neurotoxin, when the market freezes, in combination with that, when you have a liquidity event, then you see assets, even good assets, deteriorate in value quickly as people need to sell them into a market that has no liquidity. So you get sucker punched a couple of different ways. So if you can't stand low liquidity, again, you shouldn't be playing with credit derivatives. Now, if you custom tailor your contract, it will be more difficult to offload that contract because people will have to take the time to read the contract if they bother to read them at all. But that said, that's not a reason not to rewrite the language. With the ISDA standard documentation, the hype was that take our language because if everyone accepts it, it will make it easier to trade these securities.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true. Until credit events happen, and then everyone pulls out their documents and say, oh, my God, what did I sign?
Right. So in this case, we have derivatives, which actually can have a moderating influence. So if I actually bought, for whatever reasons, I'm a pension fund, and I'm holding a whole lot of Greek debt a couple of years ago, and I'm looking at it, and I'm saying, you know what, I would like to hedge this. I would like to protect myself. I might buy a credit default swap to cover my underlying position. That's a covered derivative, I guess. But in this, where you're saying where we have this incredible amount of leverage, those almost by definition, I suppose, have to be naked positions, meaning it's not possible for everybody to own the underlying $38 million contract in the Goldman example, right? So these are basically, they're just speculative. It's just bets at this point, right?
Well, it's not possible for everyone to own the $38 million subprime mortgage bond or the tranche of the CDO, which is a type of subprime mortgage bond. So therefore, they used credit derivatives to reference that bond.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can amplify the effect of that given bond. Well, if that given bond was poorly constructed or a piece of trash in the first place, then you've basically just allowed more people to be on to accept the risk of a piece of trash. And that's what the problem was with the global financial crisis. Now, when you looked at what happened with AIG and AIG's credit derivatives, AIG got into trouble because it sold protection with some very bad terms, by the way, as did MBIA and AMBAC, who are the former muni bond insurers. They amplified their risk by using credit derivatives and by not understanding the underlying risk and not really, in some cases, understanding the implications of their contracts.
So you're describing, this sounds fairly endemic to the system. This is sort of how it operates, and there was a, I suppose...
Well, it's how it doesn't operate, isn't it, Chris?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, time and again, if you read the profiles of the people who run these institutions, they are hagiographies, where these people are lauded. Let's take another example of problems with derivatives, J.P. Morgan, a recent example.
Right, the whale.
You had the President of the United States saying that he thinks that Jamie Dimon is a good bank manager. Well, that's not true. He has a silo within J.P. Morgan that he reported to him that blew up. I don't see how you can say that Jamie Dimon is a good manager. This was his responsibility, and they're kind of saying, well, since the rest of the firm is profitable, it doesn't matter that this particular silo blew up in a spectacular way due to negligence and, you know, basically ignoring every safety practice around grain dust. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. It's just pretty ridiculous for the President of the United States to say that he's a good bank manager, but they're counting on the American people not being very bright or not being able to handle the truth.
Right.
Let me give you another example that most people can understand. You can have a great-looking bathroom with tiles that you imported from Italy and wonderful fixtures, but if you have cracks in your grout, you failed at the most basic level. And anyone who knows anything about it can tell you that there is a huge problem and that the person who is telling you they installed a great bathroom is not a good installer, right? Well, that's Jamie Dimon, not a good installer. And it doesn't matter what Jamie Dimon says, and it doesn't matter what the President of the United States says. Water doesn't care what the President says, what Jamie Dimon says. It doesn't care that you imported your tiles from Italy. It only cares that you have a crack in your grout, and it's going to do what water does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened with Jamie Dimon's derivatives. He had leverage. He had a position that was way too big for that unit. They were making bets. This all reported to him. He wants to claim he didn't understand the size of the position and what was happening. And there was not just one failure. It wasn't just a crack in the grout. It was, you know, poor backing behind it. It was a whole bunch of other things that went wrong at J.P. Morgan that shows failure after management failure. The wrong risk manager, they had a series of risk managers, their latest one wasn't qualified, they didn't have a CFO. You know, I can go on. It's a pretty big list that the evidence shows Jamie Dimon was not a good manager and should be held on the hook for Sarbanes-Oxley violations. So again, you know, when people point their finger at derivatives, yes, the size of derivatives is a problem, but the reason it's a problem is because of control fraud and because of, you know, installers who, you know, show you their shiny imported tiles, and you're looking at it and you're saying, yeah, but I see a huge, humongous crack in your grout here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who knows what they're doing sees these problems. So you have people like myself and Bill Black who are, you know, looking at this and saying, yeah, nice tile, but I don't really care about that because you've got a huge problem. That's quite obvious. And that's what we're looking at in the global financial system right now.
So this is fascinating to me because when the subprime crisis was developing, I was writing about a housing bubble back in 2005 and 6, and it was patently obvious with just any sort of metrics that we might want to use, a house price to incomes, how many standard deviations around a normal price rise we were, how far above inflation we were. There was all kinds of evidence to say, gosh, we've got a housing bubble here. And you know, the Federal Reserve chose not to see it, and so many players chose not to see it. And now in the aftermath, we find out that, in fact, several inside players did see the cracks in this and were actively constructing bombs that were ready to blow up, Goldman being a prime example of that with their work that they were doing in writing and being the market maker on both sides of bonds that were designed to fail on these collateralized debt obligations, not bonds, but so here we are. You can look into the system, and you and Bill Black and others can clearly look into the system and say, this is constructed in a faulty manner. Therefore, there's cracks in this. And these cracks, it's in your mind then, is just a question, as it was the case with the housing market, is it just a question of when, not if, but when at some point we're going to have that water just flood through this, the cracks in this, and create extraordinary difficulties?
Well, we're seeing the difficulties already. That's why you've got the Fed printing money like crazy and why the banks needed accounting changes within the banks. It's not as if the problem went away. We just decided we'd try to cover it up, put some scotch tape on the ground.
Yep.
It's really pretty silly what we've been doing. But, you know, these problems have been obvious for a long time. And here's how perverse the system has been. We have the assassination of our ambassador to Libya in the news. Well, let's talk about another ambassador, Roland Arnall. Roland Arnall was the ambassador to the Netherlands. And before he was the ambassador to the Netherlands, he was the founder of an institution, a high-risk lender called AmeriQuest. AmeriQuest was sued by, I believe, every state in the union except perhaps one. And instead of Roland Arnall being held accountable for that, he said, well, you know, I was just the CEO. I really didn't know what was going on underneath me. And incredibly, Congress approved his appointment to be the ambassador to the Netherlands under George W. Bush. So instead of being held accountable, it was as if this guy was rewarded. Even the Netherlands didn't like it. Their newspapers were alive with why is this guy being made ambassador to the Netherlands with his track record. So this isn't a new problem, and this isn't just a problem that's occurred under the past 4 years. This has been building up under the Clinton administration, under George W. Bush's administration, under Obama's administration. It's a bipartisan betrayal. And again, it all comes down to control fraud. If you didn't have these toxic mortgages, we would have a much smaller problem. You talk about a housing bubble, but what is the source of the housing bubble? It's giving out loans to people who could not afford those loans, and often giving out loans on overvalued properties to people who couldn't afford to pay back a loan on a property that was fairly valued. So you had a lot of that kind of thing going on, which is what causes the housing bubble. So when you look at the root causes, I can't stress this strongly enough. Widespread massive fraud has been the most potent neurotoxin that is taking down our financial system. And instead of getting people to face this head on, you're getting massive denial from Congress, who keep talking about the imported tiles from Italy and how shiny they are. It's like there are a bunch of blondes in Congress and in our regulatory system. But because, you know, the regulators have a swinging door with Wall Street and they know they're going to be well rewarded, that probably won't change. And it probably won't change under Mitt Romney either. Mm. If you look at Mitt Romney's track record, he hired a former regulator from the FDIC and he got a loan with terms that were very favorable to Bain. In fact, the loan terms were so favorable that they actually had a poison pill attached so that rather than pay back creditors, Bain could pay its management huge bonuses.
Right.
And, of course, you know, the FDIC gave Bain these favorable loan terms, and wouldn't you know it, a key man from the FDIC was then hired by Bain, so he gets to participate in the bonus payday. And you see that sort of, you know, back scratching between regulators and the people they're supposed to regulate all the time. So that pretty much means for everyone in the financial system who's an investor, you are on your own. If you aren't part of the crony capitalist system, you are on your own.
And by on your own, what do you mean?
What I mean is that no one has your back.
Not the regulators?
No.
Not the...
No, the regulators serve the people that they're supposed to be regulating.
And not the prime brokerages. You're on your own.
Well, prime brokerages often are the people they're supposed to be regulating. If you look at the largest prime brokers, you know, CSSB, JP Morgan, and Goldman, so on, those are prime brokers. So I don't know what you mean when you say not the prime brokers.
Those people don't have your best interests at heart either. That's what I meant.
Lord, no. That's like saying MF Global had your best interests at heart.
So when did all this start? Is it just because we have the internet now and we can actually see these things happening in real time, so we're just observing something that's always been there, or did this start to go off the rails?
No, I think people just haven't been reading the... I think the financial media gets a bad rap sometimes. Obviously, a lot of people in the financial media have been enablers, but I think that's just because there's been a plethora of financial media that's exploded. But if you read the Wall Street Journal in the pre-internet days, they did expose the Kidder Peabodys and the Drexels and so on. And we've had, you know, books written about it in different areas. It's all finance, of course, but it's all related. You know, Barbarians at the Gate, Den of Thieves. And we have had a good body of work pre-internet days. It's just that we have a whole generation that grew up not having read that, and so they think that the internet is the source of truth, which, by the way, it isn't. I've seen a lot of bad information, a lot of hysteria, a lot of just wrong conclusions drawn on the internet. And it doesn't matter, again, as I say, it doesn't matter what the internet says or what people who don't know what they're talking about on the internet say. It doesn't matter what the president says, and it doesn't matter what Jamie Dimon says. If you've got a crack in your grout, water's going to do what it does. And, you know, if people are looking at the wrong problem or identifying the wrong problem, again, it doesn't matter. So I wouldn't say that the internet has been the be-all and end-all. I would just say that, you know, people who are comparing some of the bad things in the print media today and who can't tell the difference, then seem to dismiss all of print media. And there are some very good investigative reporters that are worth your time. And the other thing about the print media is they have the money and resources to go to the site, to physically go there, to check things out, and often to get a phone call returned, which people on the internet do not have. So it would be, I think, a bad thing if the financial media were not able to fund investigations, because often a lot of the things that you see on the internet are simply a derivative of what has been in the financial media, and they're piecing it together based on often the investigative good work of print media reporters. So it's a mixed bag. And if you don't know what you're doing, gullible people can, you know, read a lot of claptrap in both the print media and the internet and come to the wrong conclusion. So I am a mixed fan of the internet.
Well, you certainly have to learn to separate the wheat from the chaff. But there's some incredibly good reporting going on out there in the internet as well.
Well, there is, and also I would say that there are also a lot of anonymous agendas. You have a lot of anonymous bloggers. And I'm not a big fan of that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I really think, you know, why can't you stand behind your work and let your name be known? And you see a lot of trolls who are anonymous on the internet. So I'm not dismissive of the internet. I've actually used the internet to disseminate information. But I would say be wary, especially of people who are putting information out anonymously.
Oh, absolutely. There's
and that's not to detract from good anonymous bloggers. I understand that there are reasons why people may not want their identity to be known. But at some point, you know, as useful as pen names can be, I do think you have to stand up and be counted, because this is a country of individuals who need to back up their word.
I totally agree. Now, I want to get back to derivatives very quickly. So here we are. You say there's this neurotoxins in our system. There's a lot of control fraud. This has been going on for a long time. In 2008 was our shot across the bow, I guess. That would have been a great time to look across the derivative universe and say, whoa, maybe we've got a little too much leverage. Maybe we've piled things up. Since then, I believe we've actually increased the notional amount of derivatives by a little over 100 trillion. So, you know, message not learned if indeed there was risk concentrated in derivatives. Now, the derivatives, as I understand them, it's a zero-sum game. You and I might be betting on the future price of wheat or something like that, but your loss is my gain and vice versa. What is really the nature of the derivative risk that concerns you most here?
Counterparty risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the ability of the other side to pay when the crisis occurs. AIG is a stunning example of that. When push came to shove, AIG couldn't pay. So U.S. taxpayers had to bail out Goldman Sachs, CSFB, a number of other people, rather Goldman Sachs, SocGen, people who had been involved in these trades in one way or another with Goldman. And I harp on Goldman because they were the key architect of those securitizations, which were the crux of the September 2008 cash shortfall at AIG. That wasn't AIG's only problem, by the way. It just so happened that it was that problem which caused AIG's problems to come to a head. So the U.S. taxpayer had to bail these people out because AIG wasn't good for it when they needed to be. And by the way, I had talked to Jamie Dimon in August of 2007 about AIG looking at these CDOs and at that exact problem. He was here in Chicago. I called his office and said I'd like to meet with Jamie. I have something important to say that he's going to find useful or at least interesting. And he was dismissive of the AIG problem. Again, no cracks in his grout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wasn't a counterparty, but the reason I went to J.P. Morgan, well, first of all, it was because Jamie knew who I was and would take the meeting, and J.P. Morgan had the largest derivatives book in among all the U.S. banks.
Mm-hmm.
They had more than 51% market share at that time, according to the OCC, meaning if you added up the derivatives position of every other U.S. bank, J.P. Morgan had more than the sum total of every other U.S. bank.
Mm-hmm.
So given the counterparty risk and the knock-on effect of that, it would inevitably affect J.P. Morgan. And so that's why, of course, it would be of key interest to Jamie Dimon. And Jamie had a lot of influence. And so I was going to him, basically, to use his influence about this matter. And he was dismissive of it. Oh, I know what a CDO is. I know all about this. You know, I like AIG. And how did that end? So counterparty risk is the biggest risk. And if you've been reading the Financial Times, you see a lot of people who are dismissive of gold. Well, here's an interesting thing. The derivatives exchanges accept gold in satisfaction of margin calls.
Mm.
We had credit derivatives traders who wanted to have contracts on credit derivatives on the United States that would settle in gold. Because obviously if the United States is in credit trouble, what would you want? You would want gold. You don't want euros. You don't want any other currency. You want gold. The thing about gold is that you don't have counterparty risk. And if you look at the rebuttal for people who are saying that gold isn't money, well, I'm sorry, but gold is being used as money already on derivatives exchanges around the globe. Now, that wasn't true 5 years ago. It's true today. J.P. Morgan itself, around 18 months ago or 2 years ago, said it will accept gold as collateral in satisfaction of margin calls. So they've de facto said gold is a currency.
Has it been used as collateral and, more importantly, as payment so far?
Well, these are over-the-counter transactions, so I haven't seen it being used, but certainly it's eligible to be used.
Right.
in satisfaction. So I can't point you to specific examples and say, you know, this bank has delivered gold in satisfaction of its margin call. But you could ask the LME or other entities and ask them if that's been done, and if so, what percentage of contracts have seen that happen. Frankly, I'd rather give them paper currency.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you?
I would, too.
the fact remains that gold doesn't have any counterparty risk.
Yes. Excellent point.
And that's why people are looking to have gold as a certain percentage of their portfolio, because it doesn't have credit risk. That doesn't mean it can't go down in value. It can, but you won't be left with absolutely nothing.
Now, let's talk about this counterparty risk very quickly, because this, to me, is the key to this whole piece. We have a lot of financial...
Would you rather have Lehman as a counterparty, or would you rather have somebody give you gold in satisfaction of a margin?
Well, that's an easy one. I'll take the gold every day, as long as it's fully allocated and not otherwise encumbered through other arrangements. Make sure it hasn't been hypothecated and rehypothecated.
Lehman is a good example of counterparty risk in that it had a lot of leverage. Now, that leverage wasn't all tied to derivatives, by the way. A lot of it was tied to imprudent lending and assets that, you know, were the spawn of imprudent lending on its balance sheet. And, of course, it levered up through repo transactions as well. And it just didn't have the wherewithal to weather the storm. And, you know, you found it wasn't just illiquid, it was, you know, close to insolvency, despite what Dick Fult says. If you read my book, Dear Mr. Buffett, the chapters on Bear Stearns and Lehman, it is exculpatory evidence for any short seller who shorted Bear Stearns or Lehman. Not all short sellers, unlike Jim Cramer's outing,
yep.
Not all short sellers give bad information to the media in order to bring down a company. Sometimes the short sellers are giving you accurate information, but the media doesn't want to listen to it. They don't want to see the cracks in the grout.
Mm-hmm.
And Bear Stearns and Lehman are good examples of that. When they needed to meet margin calls, they couldn't. Bear Stearns, if you listen to their CFO on CNBC as it was going under, he said, we have $17 billion in liquidity, blah, blah, blah. But that was all money that it had on deposit from hedge funds. So hedge funds withdrew their money. All they did was push a button and boom, there went their $17 billion in liquidity. So, again, it's leverage, it's underlying assets, it's not just derivatives, and it's also massive control fraud, as well as people who just plain aren't sticking to the basics of their business and getting the basics correct. And that's why I would say Jamie Dimon is not a good manager. He failed at the most basic level.
Well, Jana, I'm interested in what happened, particularly, let's take the case study of AIG. So they made all of these naked derivative contracts. They weren't holding the underlyings. They had a lot of leverage. It blows up. They should have been the ultimate in counterparty risk. And if I remember correctly, I might have the number slightly wrong. Goldman Sachs was a counterparty for maybe $13 billion they were owed by AIG on these derivative contracts. And in my world, AIG unable to pay, that would have been Goldman's loss, but they were made whole, is my recollection.
No, I don't think you're correct on your facts.
Didn't AIG, didn't Goldman receive a payout from the bailout?
Yes, they did, and they received a massive payout. But here's why I say you're not correct on your facts, Chris. And I've written quite a bit about that, and I don't have all the numbers to hand. But as I say, Goldman was a key architect of AIG's distress at the time in September 2008 when it was going under. Goldman had already extracted billions of dollars from AIG in collateral calls by September 2008. And in addition, after that, the Treasury paid Goldman 100 cents on the dollar so that it got billions more.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the beginning of the story. Because if you looked at the underlying securities, these were collateralized debt obligations. Many of them should be investigated. One of them, one of the Davis Square deals, is part of a lawsuit by, I think it's Landesbank Baden-Württemberg. I may have the Landesbank wrong, but it's a German bank that has sued over Davis Square. I think it's Davis Square 6. And they're suing Goldman for fraud. Well, a different tranche of that same deal is one of the deals that was protected by AIG, and it doesn't end there. Goldman worked with SocGen and Calion to either co-create or create for them other toxic CDOs, and AIG protected them. So Goldman wasn't just a beneficiary of its own deals. It was a side beneficiary because SocGen and Calion might have sued Goldman for those deals.
Mm-hmm.
And they had gotten their deals protected with AIG. So it wasn't just Goldman. It was Goldman and Goldman's cronies who were bailed out in the AIG debacle. And none of it was investigated. And none of it has really been put in context in the mainstream media. And it didn't end there. There were other contracts that AIG had, some financings and securitizations, for which SocGen and Goldman were also given payments. And, you know, so AIG had multiple business lines. And then when AIG unwound some of their contracts, this is after the crisis, their counterparties on unwinds of other derivatives who were resolving some of AIG's problems in other areas got windfall gains because there was basically no bid in competition when AIG was unwinding those deals. So if you look at the bad deal that the taxpayer got in the AIG debacle, it was a bad deal for taxpayers, and it was a wonderful deal for all of AIG's cronies. Because any competent liquidator would have clawed back from Goldman and SocGen and Calion all of the money that AIG paid out to them before 2008, and it would have investigated them for fraud. And none of that happened.
So this is a case where I believe civil fraud has cases have already been settled, you know, after trial and out of court and all kinds of things.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, you know, if you look at Merrill Lynch, if you look at Goldman, you've gotten settlements out of court. One of the incentives for settling out of court is so that the documents that came up in discovery will not be made public because it hasn't gone to court. So these things are settled out of court, and then you don't see the criminal prosecutions from our justice system because they're not doing their job.
That's been the puzzling part. That's been the puzzling part to me, because when we saw, like, with a simple case where Bernie Madoff commits fraud, and people who had had money with him, who had taken it out up to 4 years prior to the fraud being discovered, meaning that there's very reasonable chance these people had no idea this was a Ponzi scheme. Apparently nobody did, not even the SEC. And the clawbacks happened from those client accounts years after the fact. So it seems to me that there's a clear evidence and case of fraud here, but it's not really been investigated in the full light of day because we settle out of court in the civil case and because for mysterious reasons there are no criminal prosecutions. The SEC and the Justice Department keep coming out and saying that we couldn't find any evidence of criminal wrongdoing here. In your mind, is there evidence of criminal wrongdoing here?
I'm sorry, where?
In the case of specific deals that have happened, say, in the AIG example. Do you think
I'm saying that the entire mortgage securitization process from the beginning residential mortgage-backed securities and the loans that went into them has to be investigated. Now, if you look at Carl Levin's investigation, he came up with evidence from Clayton, who is a due diligence provider, which showed that the firms that were packaging securitizations ignored their reports and basically did not disclose to investors the gravity of the situation. Now, that's a classic situation for fraud that should have been investigated.
And it wasn't, or hasn't been.
No.
No.
Not to any meaningful degree, no.
Well, this picture you're painting is one where it sounds like anything goes. The rules, such as they are, will be ignored or suspended or not followed or investigated should push come to shove. Is it, in your mind, if we have another derivatives accident, AIG style, will we again just have another bailout? And
you know, Chris, we're not communicating here because you keep harping on derivatives, and I keep saying that derivatives isn't the root cause. It's an exacerbating factor. It's, you know, people who are basically already going down the wrong road who are using derivatives to amplify the problem. And if you don't get to the root cause of the problem, it won't matter what you do with derivatives. You can have a bank that isn't very leveraged fail. And it can fail because it's giving out bad loans. And it can't get paid back. So if you don't address the root cause of the problem, you know, it won't help you to go backwards. I mean, I think we should do both, obviously, and that is, you know, unwind and contract the derivatives market by a great deal. But that alone will not solve our problems.
Well, if the whole market is shot through with fraud and derivatives are an exacerbating factor, what I'm trying to get to here is the very, very difficult but simple question, which is, how would somebody protect themselves in this particular environment? Say a small investor, medium investor, I'm a company, I'm a CFO, I'm trying to manage my funds and keep them in a safe place, I'm a pension. How do you operate financially in a financial system which is shot through with fraud?
Well, now you're asking me a completely different question, and I will give you the same answer that I give everybody, and it's a general one, and that is to invest in companies that have low amounts of debt, a strong balance sheet, a good cash position, and who are generating cash and who produce things that people want and need. And you try not to buy them when they're overpriced. Now, if you look at our current situation as an example, let's take an example of the equities market. The last time we saw equities trading at high multiples like that, as far as I can recall, is around 1987, before the stock market crashed. It's just people have nowhere to run right now. On your safe, rather, quote-unquote, so-called safe securities, you're earning so little money that you can't keep up with inflation. And that's a distortion created by the Fed to try to plug the holes in the balance sheets of our banking system. They're just printing money like crazy. So people have run to riskier assets, and it's driven up the P.E. multiples of even sound stocks, sound equities. Is that sustainable? Well, I don't know. Given that we've created such a distortion in the market, maybe we are in a new paradigm. It's just the last time that we saw P.E. multiples run up like this, it was in 87, and, you know, people who stood on the sidelines looked at that and said, oh, my God, the stock market's going up, and I'm missing out because I'm not buying stocks that I think are overvalued. And then within a couple of months, we had a huge correction, huge. And that would have been the time to buy in again. Of course, people were too afraid to buy in at that time. So are we going to have a huge correction here? I would say, if you look at 1987, yes, but given the distortions, everyone is anxious and saying, well, maybe things aren't going to turn out the same way because haven't seen this kind of distortion before, or not the same kind. However, I'm just thinking of fundamentals, and I say stocks have never been a buy when you've had the P.E. ratios up at near 20. And people are saying, well, I'm buying on forward earnings, but yet we're seeing a contracting economy right now. So I don't think those forward earnings are necessarily going to be there. And that all that said, you still have to evaluate companies on an individual basis, not in general.
Well, isn't it really a case of the Greenspan, now Bernanke put, market participants are saying, if there's another big accident, don't worry, they'll just paper that over too. And aren't we really trading on that expectation as much as we are forward earnings potentially?
Well, as I say, yes, because of the distortion that has been created. However, is that a good idea? No, I don't think it is. Unless we're going to say that, you know, we fundamentally changed how we look at financial assets, I don't think it is sustainable. I think, again, there's a big crack in the grout.
And maybe at the
although
base.
The tile's nice and shiny.
I love the picture of this bathroom. I don't like the grout right now.
Well, I've been struggling to come up with things that the average person can understand to show them how basically wrong it is and how easy it is for people who understand what's going on to recognize. And I think because, people like the Fed have hidden behind the esoterica of financial jargon, it's difficult for the average person to understand how easy it is for people like me to recognize that there's a huge problem here and that the people who are pointing out the shiny tile to you are lying to you.
And they get lots of airtime, the shiny tile people.
Yes, they do. They do. On CNBC, that's all they talk about is the shiny tile.
Absolutely. Well, as you look forward over the next few years, what is the biggest risk that you see to our overall economic and financial health?
Widespread massive fraud in the financial system. I don't know how many times I can repeat that. Control fraud.
Is this a reverse Robin Hood sort of a behavior? I mean, this control fraud sounds like a great way to loot. And that money has to come from somewhere. Control fraud's no good unless the money's coming from somewhere.
And it's the fruits of control fraud which end up being a collapse. Well, take a look at the silo that collapsed at J.P. Morgan. You see that happen time and again when you have that kind of problem. There are now 7 people at J.P. Morgan who have lawyered up. This wasn't a rogue trader.
Our favorite trader, the rogue trader, has fallen apart in this story.
Oh, it's
the rogue trader. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I know we could continue and go on. I feel like we've gotten to the root of it, which is this idea of fraud, and that this is really the core of the issue. And on top of that, we've layered all of these other pieces and levered on top of that sort of rotten core. How can people follow, obviously, your important work and your excellent clear communications? How can people follow you besides getting the books that we've mentioned so far, including Dear Mr. Buffett, and how else can they follow you?
Well, The New Robber Barons is an e-book only, and it's only available on Kindle, but it's a compilation of some of my thoughts where I talk or I explain control fraud in a variety of different ways from a variety of different institutions. Anything that I put in the public domain is on my website, and I do the primary outlet in terms of the web is the Huffington Post. Obviously, I do private client work, but that's not available to the general public. And if I can leave you with another thought, I would just say that if you look at African countries that collapse or that are run by corrupt leadership, their economies are dismal. And you see the corrupt leaders living like kings, driving Mercedes and so on. And it's what I call the corruption to production ratio. When you aren't producing very much and you have a very corrupt system, you see an economy that is in shambles. Now, the United States, you know, we're human beings. We've always had corruption in the United States, but we've had checks and balances. And our production was so brilliant that the corruption basically didn't matter that much because our corruption to production ratio was low.
Mm-hmm.
But in our lifetimes, the corruption to production ratio has gotten out of whack. And so that's why you're seeing our economy basically being drained. And you're seeing 51 million people on food stamps right now. You're not seeing manufacturing coming back to create jobs for those people, which is our biggest problem. It's one thing to have high unemployment. It's another thing to have no manufacturing to create the jobs for those people. We have some manufacturing, yes, but we've sent a lot of our jobs abroad. More fools us, because we don't have those jobs that would allow those people who are on food stamps to get jobs at factories and make enough of a living to raise their families decently. And you're seeing more of the middle class and surface jobs who can't get jobs back that pay them what they paid them before. So it's an interesting experiment in the history of the United States to see our corruption to production ratio get so out of whack.
Maybe one distinction is the original robber barons, at least they were robber baroning around real things like oil and railroads and things like that. These new robber barons, what are they producing?
Shiny tiles.
Pieces of paper, structured products, agreements, contracts, those sorts of things. It's a whole new world. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for your time, Janet.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And for people who are interested, the website is tavacolistructuredfinance.com. Easy to find and follow Janet's work there. So thanks again.
Thank you, Chris.